The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You are listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 17th of May 2022 on Monocle 24. It is 20:00 in Tokyo, 13:00 in Paris, midday here in London, and 7 a.m. in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Monocle 24. The Briefing starts now. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I am Markus Hippi. Coming up on today's program.
Ya bizi ikna etmeye mi gelecekler? Kusura bakma.
Are they trying to come and convince us? Excuse me. But they shouldn't bother.
Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan stands against Finland and Sweden joining NATO. What will that mean for security in the region? Then France gets its first female Prime Minister in decades. We find out what Elizabeth Borne and President Emmanuel Macron have set out to achieve together. All that plus the latest business news with UN Pots from Bloomberg. And we report from this year's Photo London 2. That is coming up right here on The Briefing over the next 30 minutes with me, Markus Hippi. We start today in Turkey, where President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has said he is opposed to Finland and Sweden joining NATO, adding that the Nordic nations shouldn't even bother to send delegations to Ankara to try to convince him otherwise. Let's get the latest now with Hannah Lucinda Smith, who's a journalist based in Istanbul. Hannah, good afternoon to you. What is the latest we know today?
Good afternoon. So, yeah, I mean, President Erdogan, for the past few days, ever since the prospect of Sweden and Finland joining NATO was raised, has been saying, that Turkey is going to have objections because of what he says is their links to terrorist groups. By that, he means the Kurdish group, the PKK. Now, this is really a revival of a row that stretches back 5 years to 2017, when President Erdogan picked fights with a number of European countries, including Sweden, saying that they were basically tolerating the presence of the PKK on their soil, allowing the PKK to organise, to gather funds, to hold events. And Sweden was one of the countries that he kind of picked out at that time. But, that went quiet. Nothing was really heard. And now I think it's quite a surprise to a lot of people that, this row has been brought back up now.
How much evidence does Erdogan have to support his claims of Sweden, for example, supporting PKK in its soil?
I mean, I certainly don't think there's any kind of evidence of the Swedish government, openly or in any material sense supporting the PKK. It is certainly the case that, Sweden has a large population that come from Kurdish backgrounds, some of whom have, organised groups and organised events in support of both the PKK and the PKK's Syrian wing, which is the PYD. That was the group that the US partnered with in order to fight against ISIS in Syria. Certainly those things are going on, but they also go on in another of other countries. You'll also find similar groups, a lot more low-key, a lot smaller, but similar groups in London, for example. And yet Erdogan doesn't raise kind of concerns about that to nearly the same extent that he does about countries like Sweden and Germany.
What do you think Erdogan is trying to achieve now? Is he also using this situation for domestic purposes?
I think that could certainly be the case. I think there are two things going on here. First of all, Turkey has been trying to play this kind of mediation role in the Ukraine conflict. It's supporting Ukraine in one sense, certainly kind of diplomatically, it's supporting Ukraine. It's provided Ukraine with weapons, most notably the Bayraktar drones, which have been used by great effect, by the Ukrainian army. But it's also trying to kind of keep its links with Russia going. It hasn't placed sanctions on Russian oligarchs and politicians in a way that other European countries have. A lot of the oligarchs initially came to Turkey, moved their yachts to Turkey as they were kind of fleeing other places. It's quite striking. The Russian embassy in Turkey on a number of occasions has kind of tweeted out thanks to President Erdogan to Turkey for what it terms its support. I don't think you could go quite that far. But, you know, certainly Turkey has kept better relations with Russia than with other countries. But there's an interesting thing going on here as well in terms of, you know, the Turkish population. Although broadly Turkish people are supportive of Ukraine in this conflict, there's also a very, very strong kind of anti-NATO sentiment in the country. It's not necessarily linked to what's going on in Ukraine. It's a kind of broader and far, you know, longer running thing, a kind of, you know, feeling of, well, why should Turkey be part of this alliance? You know, Turkey should be more independent. And I think that's something that Erdogan might be trying to play into a bit here as well. You know, obviously there are elections coming up in Turkey next year, really key elections, both presidential and parliamentary. Things are going quite badly for Erdogan on a number of fronts, notably the economy. And, you know, in the past, these kind of rows where he's sort of, you know, picked on things that he knows that the Turkish public will probably be behind have worked for him quite well in the past. And in fact, you know, when we look back to 2017, the last time he picked this same row with Sweden, what was happening then? Well, it was a constitutional referendum, which Erdogan won by a very, very slim and contested margin. In order to change the constitution, gather more power. And in the run-up to that, one of the things that he did was pick all kinds of fights with European countries, saying they harbour terrorists and they're anti-Turkey. So I certainly think there's some of that going on here.
Mm. Well, Sweden was announcing yesterday already that it was going to send a group of diplomats to Ankara to have talks over there to figure out what is going on in Turkey with Erdogan. Erdogan has now said that Finland and Sweden should not bother sending people to Ankara. What do you reckon will happen next?
Well, here's an interesting thing. On the one hand, you've got Erdogan, being very kind of caustic and bombastic. But on the other hand, there are other people within his circle who are taking, let's say, a more sort of moderate tone on this, most notably Ibrahim Kalin. Kalin is Erdogan's spokesman. He's been in that position for a really long time. One of the kind of closest figures to Erdogan and probably, I would say, the most experienced in Erdogan's palace when it comes to foreign policy issues. And what he's been saying is that, you know, Turkey has a number of demands that must be met before it will agree to Sweden and Finland joining NATO. Again, that's referring to a kind of tolerance of PKK-linked organisations on their soil. But he's not going nearly as far as Erdogan. My sense is what might happen is something that's happened in the past. You know, on the one hand, you have Erdogan for kind of Turkish domestic consumption, putting a very, very hard line out there. And then behind the scenes, other people within his cabinet and within his circle kind of, you know, quietly laying the groundwork. And, you know, I think that's something that we might see in the situation in the days ahead.
Do you think other NATO members could apply pressure on Turkey, considering that Turkey is actually, at the moment, the only NATO member opposing the alliance's expansion?
Yeah, I mean, certainly, and you know, Turkey has not been, let's say, the most popular member of NATO over the past few years. It's been at the kind of root of several of the debates going on in NATO, not least because of its purchase of a Russian missile defence system, the S-400, a few years ago. But the interesting thing, you know, since the start of the Ukraine conflict, Turkey's kind of regained a little bit of its, you know, reputation in NATO. It's tried to kind of position itself as an important country. Obviously, geographically, it's very important. But also in this sort of mediation position that it was trying to take, it's also quite important. But I just wonder, you know, how far Erdogan will be able to push that. You know, already he is not the most popular leader with people like President Biden, who's, you know, still hasn't kind of sat down with him and met him properly. I think that, you know, he is going to find himself coming under some pressure if he really keeps pushing this line.
Thanks, Hannah. That was Hannah Lucinda Smith in Istanbul. It's 12:08 here in London. Now here is Monaco's Carlotta Rebello with the day's other news headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Hundreds of Ukrainian fighters trapped for more than 2 months in Mariupol's Azovstal steelworks have been evacuated. Ukraine confirms almost 300 soldiers have been taken to two towns held by Russian-backed rebels. The apparent surrender of the final stronghold in Mariupol will cede full control of the city to Russia. Sri Lanka's Prime Minister says the country is down to its last day of petrol as the country faces its worst economic crisis in more than 70 years. The island nation's economy has been hit hard by the pandemic, rising energy prices and populist tax cuts. There have been large protests against President Gotabaya Rajapaksa in recent weeks. The White House has announced a partial lifting of sanctions imposed on Cuba by former President Donald Trump. The new measures include expanding flights beyond Havana and restarting a program to reunify Cuban families in the United States. And the Monocle Minute reports on the opening of the 75th annual Cannes Film Festival. You can find out more by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are today's headlines. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Carlotta. To France now, where President Emmanuel Macron has picked Labour Minister Elisabeth Borne as his new Prime Minister. Borne is only the second woman in French history to hold the position, and the first to do so in the last 30 years. Joining me on the line from Paris is Florence Biedermann, who's an AFP journalist and news editor. Good afternoon to you, Florence. How would you introduce the new French Prime Minister to us?
Hi, Marcus. Well, I introduced her as a technocrat, first of all. She has never been elected, and she has been Minister of Transport under Macron, then of Environment, then of Labour. Like, she's a very competent woman, an engineer coming from an elite school, Polytechnique, and all her life, like, she has been, you know, working for the French state in very high positions, mainly, by the way, before Macron, for socialist governments. So she's not very known in France. Not her, her face is not that popular. She has been working pretty hard as minister. She was pretty also successful in what she did. But let's say the French people don't really know her. So now everybody is reading here and there, who is this woman? Where is she coming from? But somehow, you know, in choosing her, Macron ticked several boxes. Like, she is, as I said, like, she worked previously under socialist minister. So she won't be someone completely in opposition with the social democrat ideas in France. And she is also not a too charismatic woman, which is good when you're a prime minister, because traditionally in France, you shouldn't be perceived as too bright and too charismatic, because you could be kind of a competitor to the president.
Exactly. Tell us more about what Emmanuel Macron wanted to achieve by appointing her as prime minister.
Well, he hopes, as she has this experience already of negotiating with trade union, she was head of the National Railway Company for a while, and she managed, by the way, to change their pension plans, although they had been fighting against this reform for months. So he hopes he can use her to push forward one of his main reforms, which is postponing retirement age from 62 to 65. So this is a very controversial point in France, and he hopes she can be the woman to achieve that. Also because it seems that after the general election, the coming election in June, his main opposition may come from the new alliance on the left, led by far left leader Jean-Luc Mélenchon. So she will have, like, she is supposed to be the one who can deal with this very left-wing opposition and soothe the worries of the trade union and eventually manage to push forward the reform.
What do you think? What kind of discussions will she be having with President Macron? How compatible are her views with Emmanuel Macron?
Oh, she's a complete Macronian. I mean, from the start, her name was mentioned as a possible prime minister. And although Emmanuel Macron said just after he was elected that he wanted a new form of government, something new, like he has rebranded his party. Now it's not La République En Marche, but Renaissance, Rebirth. Well, it seems like she's really coming from his close circle. You know, she was one of her first allies. When he created his party, she was already a member of La République En Marche. And she, you can expect definitely, as she's not perceived as very political, that she will be, you know, the loyal and faithful executant of the president's policy, not taking too many personal initiative.
Florence, how big of a deal is gender in French politics in 2022? How groundbreaking is it that the country now has the first female prime minister in decades?
Yeah, unfortunately, it seems like something big, you know, which I think says a lot about the machism in the political class. Like, it's possible. Oh my God, we have a woman prime minister. Look at all the European countries around. I mean, you know, from Theresa May to Angela Merkel to Sweden, whatever. I mean, somehow we look pretty backward. But of course, like the staunch feminists will tell you, oh, there is nothing to be marveled about. Like, she's a woman, so what? It's normal. But still, no, as you said, the first in 30 years, yes, it's something.
Now that she's going to start her new job as a prime minister, what do you expect? What will her relationship be with the French public? You mentioned earlier that French people are now trying to figure out who she actually is.
This is a bit speculative, but she is not, as I said, very famous. She's not the woman, you know, who wants to take the light. So it seems she will rather be a technician. She will maybe keep a low profile compared to Macron. And this is what he expects, you know, like someone really competent and who managed, you know, in a difficult time for Macron, because, you know, after the election, everybody realized, like, more than the presidential election, more than half of the vote went to extreme right or extreme left parties. So he needs someone he can rely on, who does the job, who is straightforward. How it will be perceived by the French, I mean, this remains to be seen. It will also depend on the result of the general election next month, how many MPs, for example, the left alliance will get, how strong an opposition they can be, whether, you know, they will kind of create some movement in social circle, like demonstration, a strong opposition. So it all depends on the results of this election. But let's say, as what you can perceive of her so far, she's, you know, it's not that she creates enthusiasm. You say, oh my God, it's Elisabeth Borne that has been elected. But you know, the former Prime Minister Jean Castex also was kind of someone not known at all by the public. And in the end, like, he managed pretty well. He's not the most popular politician in France, but he managed to do a serious job, and I think people can acknowledge that at least.
Florence Biedermann from AFP in Paris, thank you very much for joining us today. You are listening to The Briefing on Monaco 24. It is almost 2017 in Seoul, 14:17 in Helsinki, and 12:17 here in London. You are listening to Monocle 24. I am Markus Hippi. It's time now for a look at the latest business news, and I'm joined once again by Bloomberg's Euan Potts. Good afternoon, Euan. Shall we talk about what's going on in China? There seems to be some optimism that Shanghai's lockdown may soon ease.
Marcus, yeah, perhaps some light at the end of the tunnel for the 26 million residents of Shanghai. Now, the city tentatively starting to unravel its punishing lockdown. It's confined millions of people to their homes for weeks on end. But the Chinese financial hub has reported a third consecutive day of no new COVID infections in the broader community. It says that all 16 of the city's districts have seen no community spread. Now, that's the crucial milestone that authorities have said will allow them to start to unwind these really strict curbs that have hampered economic activity and caused difficulties and probably misery, really, for many, many people. Really, really tough measures in Shanghai. The city reporting a total of 823 COVID infections for Monday. That's down about 100 on Sunday. If you compare that to a month ago, Shanghai was seeing almost 30,000 cases a day. I think many people really weren't sure that Shanghai could get things down quite in the way they have, but they have been really strict with their measures. Bloomberg's seen some documents as to how the lockdown is going to progress over the next few days. Many residents must still produce a pass to get out of their compounds and can only leave by bike or foot. And the passes that we've seen show that residents probably only leave twice in the next 4 days. So plenty of strict restrictions on people's lives still remaining in Shanghai. But it does seem that they've got this outbreak under control, which is pretty impressive, although it has been brutal in places. Useful for the global economy. Of course, Shanghai is an enormous city. A lot of production takes place in and around Shanghai. And the world's biggest port is just on the city's borders as well. So very important for global trade and for global production. So useful from an economic perspective as well as a human perspective.
How desperate do you think Beijing has been to ease those lockdowns, considering that the figures yesterday told us that China's jobless rate rose to 6.1% in April, which is the highest level since the 6.2% peaks in the early days of the pandemic in 2020?
Yeah, Marcus, you're right to flag those figures. There's a huge amount of skepticism that the Chinese government is going to hit its GDP targets. Of course, China has been an enormous driver of global growth over the past 20 years, but the economy is performing less well than it has done for a long time. The country still has pretty ambitious targets for GDP growth, but many commentators just think they're not going to hit them. So much of the economy has been struck by COVID, or rather by the measures to contain COVID. It's not so much that there is COVID in China. There's plenty of COVID all over Europe, but our economies are open and functioning. And in China, many places, it is just not the case. Beijing, a district in Beijing, is locking down for the next 7 days after new clusters emerged. There's a city in the west of the country, in the Sichuan province, which has posted 400 infections over the past week. So China is just playing whack-a-mole with these COVID infections and attempting to keep them under control. And that is really crippling the economy. And as you say, some of that economic data coming out of China has really not been that good. We had PMI numbers, that's the Purchasing Managers Index, last week, and that showed a serious contraction in the Chinese economy, where much of the world is growing at a fairly decent pace.
Then you're looking at some other news. What's the latest regarding Elon Musk's Twitter takeover?
Well, yeah, this is quite a story, isn't it? Elon Musk has declared that he's not going to proceed with his takeover of Twitter unless the social media giant can prove that bots make up fewer than 5% of its users. Now, this $44 billion takeover has really been a willy won'ty story over the past few days. The billionaires tweeted that this deal cannot move forward unless Twitter provides proof of its claims. Now, Twitter says that bots, these automated machines that tweet things out, make up less than 5% of its users. Elon Musk contends that number is much, much higher. Now, the latest tweet from the billionaire really complicates an already chaotic takeover. And he recently butted heads with the Twitter CEO over the way that the social media giant accounts for bots. That really stoked speculation that Musk may attempt to lower the price or even walk away. There is a walking away clause in the deal, which means that he should have to pay $1 billion. But Musk is being pretty bold on this. Twitter's shares are really a measure of where the market thinks this is going. They fell another 2% in pre-market trade in New York this morning. Yesterday, they slid by 8%. Now, Musk has offered $54.20 for Twitter. And this last trading price is currently 40% below that. So that is really a measure of what the market thinks the likelihood of this deal is. If the market thought that this was a done deal and that Musk was definitely going to buy Twitter at $54, then you would expect the shares to be priced pretty much near $54. They are not. They're trading 40% below that. So the market's view is this is not going to happen, or it's not going to happen at that price.
Quite a news story. Ewan Potts from Bloomberg, thank you very much for joining us today. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
How long do you think it would take you to travel the world to hear from the most perceptive and relevant speakers on the global news agenda? To mix that up with a trip to visit the business people benchmarking best practice in media, retail and hospitality. And to make time, too, to delve into a rich mix of great design stories and rich cultural discoveries. All this while being entertained and inspired by a cast of worldly and witty editors and correspondents. Well, you can do all of this in just 60 minutes each week by tuning in to The Curator, a whistle-stop tour of the best of the last 7 days on Monocle 24. Tune in to The Curator, subscribe and download the show now, or listen every weekend on Monocle 24.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Briefing with me, Markus Hippi. Finally on today's show, this weekend saw the latest edition of Photo London, a major photography fair held in the capital every May. On display was photography from Ukraine to Gabon to the United States, some vintage and some contemporary and experimental. Photo London also highlights emerging talents and exciting new trends in photography. Monocle's Lillian Fawcett was there, and she sent us this report.
Photo London's founders wanted to be an antidote to the usual art fair experience. Instead of organising the event in a tent, they wanted to do it in a palace, which is why they've held it at London's Somerset House every year since its relaunch in 2015. Michael Benson and Fariba Fashad are the fair's founding directors.
Photo London is one of the world's great photography fairs, probably one of the two great photography fairs in the world. We have 108 galleries from 18 countries worldwide showing this year. We also have two fantastic exhibitions, one by our master of photography, Nick Knight, and one by Frank Horvath.
How do you go about choosing the exhibitors and curating this huge exhibition? Where do you even begin with something like that?
Well, we begin about the day after the fair closes, because our aim is to have the very best group of exhibitors we possibly can, which is why we have a curatorial committee. And we spend quite a lot of time talking to galleries, asking them what they're planning to bring, seeing whether that'll work in London. There's a particular issue about whether photography, people are bringing works in London. So it's a year-long process. By January of next year, we will have the group of galleries, and it will be a surprise to us. We will, the nice thing about the fair is we go away at the end of the fair and think, so what next?
And it's obviously important for you to have a very international exhibition as well, isn't it?
This year, for example, we got 106 galleries from 18 countries, and it's always been, this is our seventh edition in London, and always been very much international, American and French specifically been present. And obviously this year, from, even after 2 years of pandemic, you have variation of countries, like from South America to
Iran.
The discovery section of Photo London presents some of what's happening at the kind of frontiers of photography. What's on offer there this year, and what kind of new exciting innovations are we seeing in photography? What are some of the emerging themes there?
One of the themes is this business of the boundary, crossing the boundaries between photography and other art forms, in particular this year in discovery, sculpture. So there's quite a lot of galleries which are presenting sculptures as well as photography. So that's an important theme. There's a lot of experimentation based on previous, or sort of, if you like, old techniques of photography. So there's galleries like Equinom who present work that is by artists who are using techniques which have been around since the dawn of the medium.
One of the fair's main exhibitions this year is a collection by groundbreaking fashion photographer Frank Horvath, curated by his daughter Fia Mena.
Your listener might not know that he passed away not very long time ago, so it's beautiful to have a first homage, particularly in London, because he had a long relationship with this town. And I'm also very grateful because fashion photography is still struggling to define itself as photography. So it's quite brave, which is amazing, but it is quite brave in a photo fair to celebrate fashion photography. And it's beautiful, and we decided to show the fashion side and also a much more intimate side, which is the nightlife in Paris in the 50s.
Fia Mena points out that while the images look classical, at the time they were revolutionary. Frank was known for getting models out of the studio and into unstaged outdoor settings. One image for Vogue in 1961 shows a woman in a three-piece tweed suit on a cobbled street in Yorkshire, surrounded by smiling children. In another, a bride rides the Paris tram, veil and all.
It's actually quite technical, because you have to imagine that at the time, fashion photography was done in studios with quite heavy equipment, with lighting and everything. And even physically, the girls would have tons of makeup, wigs, eyelashes. I mean, the whole thing was quite artificial, however beautiful. I think he really came with that need to explore the inside, that he was very much into introspection all his life. And I think he even came into fashion with this idea that you have to show the true woman, which seems to us crazy when you see the image because they look so classical. But actually, it was really important. So he would remove the makeup. Famously, he would sometimes make them cry because those women, they felt very vulnerable without their eyelashes. And he would bring them outside.
Photo London's coveted Master of Photography Award this year went to Nick Knight, whose work explores different mediums. Here's co-founder Fariba again on what Nick Knight and Frank Horvat have in common.
Both in different era, they were, and he is, Nick Knight, breaking the boundaries and, you know, changing the face of, you know, photography or the perception of fashion photography, and in their own area making a major revolution almost. And a lot of artists here are following and experimenting, and that's beautiful to capture.
That was a report by Monocle's Lillian Fawcett at this year's Photo London. And that's all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Carlo Tarabello. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett. And our studio managers were Callum McLean and Christy Evans. The Briefing is back tomorrow at the same time. I am Markus Hippi. Goodbye and thanks for listening.